I'm Gregory Berg. The following morning show interview was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2008. Enjoy. Well, if you happen to be a connoisseur of Truman Capote, or maybe an admirer of Harper Lee and what she did in the pages of To Kill a Mockingbird, you might very well then find fascinating a brand new book, a novel called Capote in Kansas, A Ghost Story, written by an author by the name of Kim Powers, who actually has won awards for different kinds of writing, for ABC's Good Morning America and for Primetime. He turns his writing abilities to a very different genre and to a most intriguing scenario, trying to look beneath the intriguing relationship, friendship between Truman Capote and Harper Lee. And he's done so in fascinating fashion. And this book, published by Carroll and Graff, is interesting on all kinds of different levels. And I'm glad that for the next few minutes we can talk with Kim Powers about this novel, again called Capote in Kansas, A Ghost Story. Kim Powers, we welcome you to the morning show.
That's a great build-up, Greg. Thank you.
Let me ask you before we start talking about this novel, what does a writer do on a program like Good Morning America? I mean, and forgive me for asking that. I mean, honestly and truly, I watch that program a lot, but it never even dawns on me that there are writers on a program like that.
It didn't occur to me either before I started the job there. The writers are sort of the secret weapons of it, the hidden weapons of it. And we actually prepare the whole show in advance by doing pre-interviews with the guests on the phone, coming up with the questions that the anchors will ask them. We'll talk with the guests the day before, write down what their responses will be, or sort of the general gist of what their responses will be. If the story needs a little setup piece to explain it or whatever, we'll write a little tape piece that goes along with it. I happen to do a lot of the entertainment and celebrity stuff they did, a little bit more pop culture stuff than hard news stuff, because that was my interest and my forte. So I was always running around and picking out film clips to show and pictures of the actors and any of the very sort of emotional kind of heart-tugging stories that Diane Sawyer often did. I wrote those for her. Not to say that the anchors don't go off on their own and write what they want to, but you sort of give a flow chart to the piece that they can follow when they're the poor souls who have to get up at 4 in the morning and drag into the studio. We've sort of done all our work the day before.
Hmm.
But it's odd. I don't think anybody realized, as I said, certainly I didn't, that writers and producers really sort of craft those segments so that the control room has kind of a general idea of what's going to happen during it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it's probably a tribute both to the quality of the writing, that it sounds like it's just sort of spontaneously springing from Diane Sawyer or Robin Roberts.
And that's the gift of great anchors like Diane and Robin. And when I was working there, Charlie Gibson was on it, who's, you know, just a master. They kept me away from doing anything too hard or too smart, any of the sort of breaking news stories about politics or the war that happened in the first half hour. But, it really is. You go in with kind of a script in hand, as it were.
Fascinating. If you were still working there, would you be on strike right now?
I would not, and that's, thank goodness I wouldn't be, and I'm currently still at ABC writing for 2020 in primetime. We are part of the Writers Guild, but our news writers at ABC are under sort of a different contract, so we were not. I mean, we were certainly welcome to picket with the writers here in New York, et cetera, but we did not have to go on strike. And it looks like happening just today that the strike is over pretty much. So that's good news for all of my buddies who wrote for TV shows and all my friends who were TV directors, that they'll be able to get back to work now.
Right. Very good. So what inspired you to step away from that sort of work into the crafting of a novel like Capote in Kansas? And I don't even mean so much specifically the story or
right.
what you did here, but just in general, undertaking a project like this?
Well, I had always been doing a lot of writing projects on the outside. I'd had a lifelong fascination with Harper Lee and Truman Capote that came from my childhood when I saw the movies of their two great books. It's kind of embarrassing for a writer to admit, but I think I was very late to the game in actually reading To Kill a Mockingbird and certainly In Cold Blood, but I sort of religiously went to see the movies every Saturday afternoon in a little small town in Texas that I grew up in, and saw Mockingbird and was just haunted by it. I didn't understand a lot of it. A lot of it sort of went over my head, the more adult parts of it. But I really thought I was kind of looking at a picture of my own childhood, of hanging out late at night, playing out on the street, you know, waiting for that screen door to slam, to hear that as the signal you had to go in for the night, and then equally sort of haunted and terrified by In Cold Blood and the murder of the Clutter family, and terrified that burglars were going to come into my own house, even in, you know, suburbia, Texas, and kill us all. So I'd always been writing, and I had done a first book, a memoir called The History of Swimming, that is about me and my twin brother and our sort of very troubled relationship. And after that, I didn't want to be a one-note writer. I didn't want to just keep retreading my own personal story. And I just immediately thought of the story of Capote and Lee and the sort of secrets in it that none of us really know about. I'd started writing the book long before the two Capote movies came out, and thought I was going to be the one to sort of, break news of this fascinating backstory that they had, that they grew up together as kids in Alabama, and that 30 or some odd years later, she went to Kansas with him to be his assistant as he started In Cold Blood. Those movies sort of beat me to the chase, which I was very depressed about for a while. And then I thought, no, it's actually a good thing. My book delves into so many things that I don't think are touched on in either of those two movies, really getting to the heart and soul of their relationship. So I thought it was just prime material, just, you know, waiting to be explored. You know, there had been some biographies of Capote, and then last year a biography of Lee called Mockingbird. But I don't think, as brilliantly researched as they all were, I didn't really feel the heartbeat of the characters. And I really wanted to get to that. And to do that, I knew I had to sort of jump off on a fictional track. I couldn't just, report what's, you know, it was written in a newspaper. I really had to let all my creativity and imagination sort of go into it and really try to make these characters tick for an audience.
I'm so intrigued by something you say in the author's note in talking about your introduction to both of these writers and how their work sort of came alive on the screen and so on, particularly when you talk about To Kill a Mockingbird. And you said that beautiful scene of the father sitting next to his son all night long.
Yeah.
You said after a childhood of broken arms, an absent father, and terrors both imagined and real and only partially glimpsed, I wanted somehow to live inside that story. And those words are just breathtaking, because I'm sure we don't often enough think of that being one of the most important facets of a great story, is that it is a story that we sometimes, depending on the story, want to climb inside of it and experience it and wrap it around us.
I had not thought of that sentence you just read in a while. It makes me very emotional, because I did. I mean, I said just a second ago I would go see the movies every weekend, but I didn't experience them at a remove. I really thought I was in them. I mean, I could sort of project myself into the screen and being the car, you know, with Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello or whoever I was watching. And it was an escape from my life. And I did have these, as I write, they're two broken arms, not at the same time, but I broke one arm literally the day after I got the other arm out of the cast. My father was a very sort of missing in action figure, and I craved a father like Atticus Finch, like I think so many of us did, you know, the lawyer played by Gregory Peck that Scout and Jim have, and just a tender father who would be there with me to chase the boogeyman away, you know. And I think that line, the last line of Mockingbird, and I'm going to do it a horrible misjustice by misquoting it, but it's something like an you know, they've just been attacked by Tom Ewell, and Jim has broken his arm, and Boo Radley saves them. And the last line is something like, talking about Atticus, and he would be there with him all through the night and be there when Jim woke up in the morning. And I just think it's the most exquisite final line in the book ever. And I think that's what so many of us wanted, you know. I mean, all of our personal stories change, of course, but we want that comforting father figure, parental figure there. And I think that's why I so particularly was attracted to Mockingbird, because it had that. It had both the comfort of childhood and the terror of it as well.
Right.
You know, the Boo Radley, the haunted house in the neighborhood, at that last scene in the movie, or right before it, when Scout is dressed up like a ham, you know, for the agricultural pageant, this ham outfit made out of paper mache and chicken wire. And there's that little cutout band where her eyes can see, but it's very limited, her vision, and she can only see a certain thing and not see everything around her. I just think that's such a perfect metaphor for childhood and how we try to get through it.
Mm. It's interesting that you found yourself drawn to To Kill a Mockingbird, and in a sense to a sort of father figure that was not present in your own life. And we certainly get the sense also in this, in the pages of this book, as you write about young Truman Capote, that there are probably some echoes between his early life and yours. In one of the scenes where he is sort of calling up his friend Harper Lee in kind of a sort of a drunken swirl, as she tries to make sense of what these calls are about. It was the truth of a little boy who was all alone, who knew he was different, who knew his mother hadn't loved him no matter how hard he tried, and not let on to anybody else. I mean, it's a picture of somebody who is sort of on the outside looking in, and the scars of that go with him for a long, long time.
Greg, you've so done your homework. You're just killing me with these lines. You're picking out all of my favorite lines in the book.
Hmm.
It's odd. You know, I was flicking around on TV. I hate to keep referring back to the movie of Mockingbird, but I just think it's so perfect. And it was on TV the other night, and I got sucked into it. And one of the things I learned right after I saw it as a kid is that the character of Dil Harris in it, the kind of neighbor who comes to visit every summer, and the rest of them are running around, you know, barefooted and in overalls, and he's always got his pressed white linen and his knee socks on. That was based on Truman Capote, her, you know, next-door neighbor. And I happened to wander into the movie at exactly the moment that he had come into the kitchen of Scout and Jim and is bragging about his father being this important railroad man who fell in love. I might be getting my Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams mixed up, but he said he fell in love with long distance. Mm. And he was a father who was gone. And then his mother, Truman's mother, was the society woman who really couldn't stand children, to be blunt about it, and kind of dumped Truman as a young boy off with his relatives in Alabama, took off for New York to kind of reinvent herself as a society woman and married well. And I think that in many ways, his mother, who renamed herself Nina, you know, kind of a sophisticated name, was the role model for Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Hmm. You know, if you remember this woman who looks like the life of the party and the society girl, and but her, you know, older husband comes to find her, and you discover, in fact, she's this old country girl, you know. Truman just did not have parents who were there for him. And I think that's why he so identified with one of the killers of the Clutters, Perry Smith, who also had a very checkered family life. His mother had abandoned him, and you would never, you know, imagine someone as sort of sophisticated and worldly as Truman could find anything to relate to in this horrible killer, but they did. I mean, that was, I think, Truman's genius as a writer, that he could sort of go under the surface of a character and find the commonality in all of us, you know.
Especially a figure that repulses us,
exactly,
as this figure does in Cold Blood.
Yeah.
You write, I think, so sensitively, too, about how, for a youngster like Truman Capote, writing would be such an important source of solace. Mm-hmm. I want to read one of my favorite moments in the book. It was up in that tree in the backyard of the old Lee house that she and Truman had first become writers. Each of them provided an essential ingredient besides imagination and loneliness. Nellie, a beat-up old Underwood typewriter that her father had donated to the cause, and Truman, a waterlogged Webster's dictionary that he carried everywhere, practically bowed down by its weight. It was his pride and joy, as precious and crucial to him as a teddy bear might have been to another needy child.
Again, one of my favorite sentences, and not just sentence, one of my favorite images of Harper and Truman. And you know, I came to writing sort of late in the game. You know, I'd done various other things in my life, but we do know those few rare kids who grow up knowing that that's what they're going to be, that in fact that's all they can be. And I, based on the research I did about Truman, I think that's what was true in his life. From the time he was a kid, he was looking around the neighborhood and writing little short stories about the characters in it. And like I write, I maybe in the there's a wonderful Gerald Clark biography of Truman just called Capote, and it's sort of the masterwork. And I think that's where I found this reference to him finding this waterlogged Webster's Dictionary. And, you know, this strange changeling child who looks so different from all the other Southern kids there, and just carting it around like, you know, somebody else would cart around a go-kart or a stuffed animal. It was just exhilarating and heartbreaking to me at the same time that his favorite friends were words.
And his best friend was someone's discarded dictionary. Mm-hmm. You said the memory of a child who loved words so much he slept with them under his pillow,
right,
so they would burrow into his head at night.
Exactly.
This friendship between Harper Lee and Truman Capote, how much do we know about it in fact versus how much of it can we only imagine?
The two sort of anchor posts of it that we do know are real and factual are their childhood together in Monroeville, Alabama, where Truman lived until he was 7 or 8 years old, I think. Harper Lee's father was in fact the role model for Atticus Finch. His real name was Amasa, wonderful sort of Southern name. He was a lawyer like Atticus. He ran and was the editor of the town newspaper. Truman was dumped off with relatives. The great Sook, his old cousin that he writes so beautifully about in A Christmas Memory, was one of his cousins who took care of him. So we know that much is true. Then you sort of jump 25, 30 years later, he calls up Harper Lee, who at that point is also living in New York trying to be a writer. She went to law school for one semester like her father wanted her to, didn't like it, left for New York, like all of us who, you know, move here from a small town, took any job she could get. She ended up working as a reservations clerk at the old British Airways. And while she wasn't doing that, she was, you know, I think I write at one point in the book, trying to sweat out the story of her childhood, you know, writing what began as a collection of short stories called Amasa, that then, once she sold it, got sort of shifted and shaped into the novel called To Kill a Mockingbird. So then she went off to Kansas with him, not for the whole time. He ended up spending about 6 years working on In Cold Blood. She was just there for several of the very early trips. After that, we really don't know much. Truman gives the dedication in Cold Blood to her and to his lover at the time, a man named Jack Dunphy, and it says something like, with great thanks and admiration. he invited her to his infamous black and white ball. She did not attend, and that's where the mystery begins. That's what I was so fascinated by. What happened to these two former best friends to cause this great divide between them? She ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize for To Kill a Mockingbird. He did not win it for In Cold Blood, which he'd expected. And I think there's a degree of jealousy that splits them apart. My imagination went into overdrive in the book, and I speculated about other things that could have driven them apart as well.
Hmm.
But the machine I kind of create for the book, and where he picks up his phone one last time in what turns out to be the last year of his life, 1984, and says the ghosts of the Clutters are coming back, they're haunting him. And of course he's delirious from drugs and alcohol. But he picks up the phone and she says, they're coming to me as well. And it's the sort of closure I wish they would have had in real life. I mean, I don't know that they didn't, but it's certainly never been written about. He didn't write about it. And she, who's, of course, still alive, has really never talked about it or commented on it.
Hmm. Woven into this fascinating book is not only this central relationship, sometimes friendship, I mean, oddly persistent connection between these two. Also woven into the story, which I think is so intriguing, which we need to talk about for a minute or two at least, is the relationship between Truman Capote and his housekeeper, Myrtle Bennett. You mention in the author's note again, and of course she's a very potent presence in the pages of the book, that she is a feisty presence and important to him, and in certain moments, we get a sense that this is as important a relationship in Truman Capote's life as any that he has, at least in these waning years.
I'm so glad you brought her up, because so many people have just concentrated on Truman and Harper, but she's there in full figure as the third central character in the book. And she's very much based on a real woman. He had a housekeeper named Myrtle Bennett, who had been a former Cotton Club dancer. And I love that image, too. Somehow, you know, life had not treated her well. She ended up being a housekeeper for him. How he came to find her, I don't know. But after he had known all the glittering lights of New York and European, you know, capitals, etc., she was really his only friend at the end of the day. He had so turned his friends against them by writing about them in the few chapters of Answered Prayers that exist. He was essentially kind of drummed out of high society. And at the end of his life, this lowly educated black woman was his best friend and confidant.
Mm.
I have a scene where he, and this is again, the core of it is based on a real thing. We all have heard about the famous black and white ball he had, but at a later point he wanted to throw an even bigger ball and started casting about for different ideas about it, and he was going to throw something with an Arabian Nights theme. So that much is true. What I fictionally have him doing is starting to write a guest list for it, and he divides a sheet of paper in two columns, like who to invite, who not to invite, and the only name, the first name that comes to him to invite is Myrtle Bennett, and he can't think of anyone after that he wants to have come to his party.
you painted another nice picture at another point after a busy night has finished up, in which you say, "She fixed up the house whenever his big city friends came to visit, but he always told her his favorite time was just after they'd left, when it was just him and her again."
Yeah.
And of course, this is a woman who probably scarcely understands really who he is or what he's done or what's in the pages of these fancy books he's written. And yet there is something very real between the two of them.
Exactly. And she develops cancer in real life and in the book. In real life, she died before Truman did. And I was devastated to sort of learn that. And I sort of grieved, you know, her as a character, just like I did the other two. And She almost is the one of those three primary characters, the one I would most like to meet in all of them. And I got to work. I actually think there's a lot of humor throughout the book, sort of a little subversive humor. But she sort of began as this tool to get a little more humor and comic relief into it, and then she really became this kind of poignant, heartbreaking character who suffered for Truman and just spent all of her time worrying about what was going to happen to him instead of what was going to happen to her after she got this cancer diagnosis.
Right. A minute remains. Harper Lee is still alive, correct?
She is. Yes, she is.
Do you ever think about the admittedly somewhat remote possibility that she might read this book?
I do. I don't know if I want her to or don't want her to. I mean, on one hand, I so revere Mockingbird. I would love her to read, you know, a fan's testament to her. I don't know if she'd completely appreciate everything I've written about her, although I sort of think she would. I mean, I knew I was being audacious when I sort of, you know, set this task for myself that if she wasn't going to sort of talk and spill all of her secrets, I would do it for her and probably make up some secrets along the way. But I sort of live in fear and terror that, you know, someday I might get a phone call from her, hopefully from her, not from her attorneys or anyone,
right,
and that she would get sort of a kick out of it, you know?
I certainly did reading it. The book is called Capote in Kansas, A Ghost Story. It's published by Carolyn Graff, a fascinating book that really stays with you after you've read it. And the author is Kim Powers. Kim Powers, I'm so glad I got to read
Greg,
your book and talk with you about it.
I have not had a more delightful interview about the book, and you just ask such insightful questions. I really appreciate your attention to it. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.